Despite the fact that the economy has yet to recover from the worst recession since the Depression, economic forecasters are claiming that things are back on track, partly because the appetite for luxury goods has returned. In fact, if attendance at the recent Reuters Global Luxury and Fashion Summit is any measure, 2011 is expected to be one of the strongest years for luxury goods in recent history. Among the products gaining popularity are men's designer handbags. The demand for high-end luxury goods catering to the ultra-rich has spread to China, where new millionaires and billionaires are looking for ways to splurge their riches. In his newest book, author and professor R.T. Naylor chronicles the various luxury goods industries and the impact they have on the environment and society. Crass Struggle, and that's C-R-A-S-S, Crass Struggle, Greed, Glitz, and Gluttony in a Wanna Have World also examines what Naylor calls the rot at the core of today's modern jungle of extravagant spending. Here is part one of a two-part interview with the author.
Welcome to Uprising, Professor R.T. Naylor.
It's good to be here, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we get into the real content of your book, how the luxury goods industries and other industries that the super wealthy have essentially created, let's talk about how incomes themselves have become more and more and more unequal over the past few decades, leading us to this place we are in now, where such a tiny percentage of the population owns so much wealth. How has inequality, just here in the United States alone, changed over the past few decades?
Well, it hasn't happened because of the magic of the market. Forget all that crap. It's basically a political act. This thing was planned. Planned not in the narrow conspiratorial sense, but planned in the sense that policy was deliberately changed in order to wipe out the relative equality. It wasn't totally equal by any means, but there was a sort of relative equality that prevailed in the, say, 1950s, 1960s, early 1970s. And then there came a kind of a right-wing counter-revolution led by propaganda from economics departments but pushed by big business, starting in the States but very quickly copied almost everywhere in the capitalist world. And that took a number of forms. It took the forms of union busting, eventually leading to a great deal of outsourcing as well. It took the form of, you know, pushing up interest rates. It took the form of tax changes that did two things. First of all, they slashed the tax rates on upper income groups. And secondly, they virtually eliminated the taxes on wealth accretion. I mean, there's a big difference between earning an income and having your wealth, your assets accumulate in value. And what they did is they really greatly reduced any taxes on increases in the value of your wealth, of your assets, while at the same time almost cutting drastically the taxes on upper incomes as well. So there was a double tax thing going on there. And that again, was initiated largely in the United States and then copied slavishly all over the world, well, copied happily, actually, by the elites all over the world. So it's not a grand conspiracy. It's a class thing, let's face it. And basically the upper classes have the power, and of course it's self-reinforcing, because once they accumulate huge amounts of wealth, it's very easy to reduce the political system to simply a wholly owned subsidiary. And that's what it is right now.
How much money do the uber-rich have to play with? I mean, what qualifies somebody as being in this club of super-wealthy elite?
Well,
just to give the rest
of us
a sense of it.
There's no concrete definition. You know, it's sort of a matter of usage, and it would vary from country to country, because I would say to be super-rich is a relative term. If you're in an extremely poor country, it doesn't take a hell of a lot to be among the super-rich and therefore the super-powerful, because ultimately wealth correlates with power. And the degree of wealth and degree of power depends on what the average is and how it's distributed in your particular society. Now, on top of that, there's certainly a super elite of billionaires or quasi-billionaires who know each other, who consort with each other all around the world. But in terms of domestic politics, it's really more a relative thing. So there could well be countries in which, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars is enough to make you super wealthy, or a few million, let's say. Whereas in the United States, of course, to be a super wealthy guy, you're probably a billionaire.
Now, we get the sense that those who are super wealthy, of course, have their luxury lifestyles, but they also hoard a lot of money. But you make a point in your book that how they spend is sort of a function of how the money is accumulated in the first place.
Well, you know, there's a big transformation that's taken place, because if you went back four decades, the social structures in North America and Western Europe were relatively stable. You had some very rich people, but they weren't, generally speaking, there'd be exceptions, but they weren't flagrantly rich in the sense of always shoving it in people's face. Now, that's not because they were nice people. I think it more reflects the fact that they felt secure in their position. But what you got in the last three decades, because of these deliberately stoked asset bubbles, one after another, you got accumulation of wealth in the hands of an upstart multimillionaire to billionaire class. Now, that has two effects. First of all, new wealth is always more vulgar because it's always more insecure than old wealth. But secondly, when you get this sudden inrush of wealthy, extremely wealthy people vying for a place in the sun, the old wealth starts to feel insecure, and you get basically, a crass measuring contest between the two. The old trying to reaffirm their status, the new trying to challenge that status. So that's one of the things that we got into, that basically an increase in the level, I think, though it's hard to quantify it exactly, it's more impressionistic, but I would stand by it, an increase in the level of crass consumption exhibitionism on the part of the super rich. But simultaneously, you got it percolating down through the social ranks so that everybody seems to think that they got to flash the cash, even if they don't have it to flash.
And that's a really good question about, you know, in terms of how the demand for luxury goods and experiences in among the super wealthy elite then trickle down, that the similar desire gets created among the middle and working classes that end up, of course, only being able to afford the cheap ripoffs. But in the end, we sort of all end up appearing as though we are part of some, you know, version of the nouveau riche.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, you know, you go back into European history in the early modern times, there were sumptuary laws, and these laws prohibited the lower orders that was defined by law, the lower orders from actually imitating the consumption patterns of the rich.
Mm-hmm.
Only the rich could wear certain jewelry, wear certain furs in their hats and things like the certain clothes, certain foods and wines, even certain furniture was restricted by law to them. So if you were an upstart, you might well lose your head, or at least a hand, if you were caught trying to imitate the same kind of consumption pattern. Now, obviously, that's in an economy of scarcity. But then we get into an economy of, let's call it, temporarily abundance, because the one we're living in isn't going to last much longer.
Right.
But it's an apparent abundance. And here what you get is a competition across the social barriers. And so the competition really takes the form not even necessarily of what they spend their money, but how much they spend. You know, when you think about it, the difference between a Honda Civic and a Mercedes Excelero at $6 million, it's still a car. Just about anybody can have a car, but everybody wants the fanciest and the one with the highest price tag they could possibly afford. That, unfortunately, is the curse of our times. And that's, of course, what drives let me make one other point on this. In the old days, economic theory, I mean, the economic theory is almost always wrong because economists are almost always wrong. That's their job, in fact. But, you know, it used to be that economic theory would say, well, the economy works by investment. And people withhold money from current consumption, invest it in the creation of plant and equipment or social infrastructure. And the assumption was economic growth would be a function of how much investment was taking place. But that's certainly not true now, if it was ever true. I mean, what drives our economy is a high and rising level of consumption. Across North America, I think consumption expenditures are between 70 and 75% of gross domestic product. So you got to maintain the consumption expenditures, and that means of all social classes, in order to maintain economic growth. And if you don't have economic growth, incomes don't grow, debts don't get paid because no one has the means to pay the interest and repay the principal and so on. So you built really a classic house of cards, and it relies on the continuation of increasing levels of consumption. And this, total lunacy when you think about it, this occurs at a time when everybody's perfectly aware we live in a world with limits. And how in a world with such severe limits in terms of resources, in terms of the world's ability, the nature's ability to deal with all our garbage, how in a world with those limits can we possibly think that consumption can grow forever? It's totally psychotic.
I'm speaking with R.T. Naylor about his new book, Crass Struggle, Greed, Glitz, and Gluttony in a Wanna-Have World. Well, let's talk about some of these industries for luxury goods and experiences and items that the super rich create, and how in your book you describe in great detail most of these industries that are created because of the high demand end up having, as you put it, rot at its core. You start out with gold, which, of course, is a commodity that is highly coveted and has been for many, many years and has such an interesting history as well, such a even sordid history when we think back on the gold rushes here in the U.S. and other countries as well. One thing that was quite startling to learn was just how much waste is produced to extract gold. And of course, so many of us want, you know, the gold jewelry for our anniversaries and our birthdays, but of course the super rich can afford gold in very large amounts. Educate our listeners on what the true price of that gold extraction is.
Well, I mean, you're living in California, you know what it is, because you know the waters near California, the Pacific, was once quite pristine with huge amounts of white sturgeon and so on playing around in the thing, in the estuaries especially. And then they were largely, I mean, the ecosystem started to be destroyed during the California gold rush. But there, I mean, that raises an issue that you mentioned. There's really two problems of the waste here. One is the sheer volume of the thing. The two are interact, but I think for theoretical consideration, let's keep them separate. The sheer volume, because as you run out of easily obtainable gold close to the surface, you have to dig deeper and deeper and process more and more ore per ounce of gold you extract. Now, that means more and more tailings spread all over the place, more and more rainforest destroyed, more and more mountains tops removed, and more garbage everywhere. But the second thing that happens is that the smaller the concentration of the gold, and right now almost every gold mine operates with microscopic gold. That's what it's after. The smaller it is relative to the surrounding matrix of rock, the more toxic the process of extracting it. Now, what you have in California, and by the way, I congratulate these people who are trying to even get in California sort of artisanal gold mining banned. I don't know how far that initiative has gone, but I noticed it a couple of days ago. But anyway, in the old days, it was largely mercury. But now the big corporate producers prefer to use cyanide. Now, these things are essential when you got tiny flecks of gold or even microscopic flecks of gold, because then the gold in tiny bits, dust or microscopic, bonds with the mercury or with the cyanide. It's used for amalgamation. But, of course, that means flushing huge amounts of mercury into the rivers and streams and then eventually into the oceans, or it goes up into the air and then falls as, well, mercury pollution in many forms, turns into methyl mercury, et cetera. Anyway, there's long story there. It's a pretty hideous story. But arsenic, it's the same thing. Now, the big companies will tell you the cyanide photodegrades, but most of it ends up in places where there's no sunlight. So the cyanide can poison huge amounts of land and huge amounts of waterways, wiping out fish along. Well, there was one spill in the Danube that wiped out all the fish life for 150 miles. Now, those things, I mean, granted, they aren't everyday occurrences, but every major mine surrounded by all of these tailings exposed in the mining process is leaching heavy metals, and acids into the surrounding ecosystem.
You know, what you describe in the way gold is extracted is reminiscent of the oil industry going after harder and harder and harder to find oil, making the extractive process
no
more
question.
And more toxic. However, at least oil is used to power, you know, things that take, you know, food, transport food from one place to another, et cetera. But in this case, we're talking about something that is extracted for sheer vanity.
Well, there used to be some industrial use
sure.
of gold, but
yeah.
there are fewer and fewer, and there's so much gold already in existence. After all, let's remember, gold is a thing that lasts forever. It's the closest to the eternal metal that we're ever going to have.
And diamonds.
Well, yeah, but that's not of any more any practical use
sure,
except
sure.
for people's vanity. Because, now there are synthetic substances that are much harder than diamonds.
I was referring to the standard, slogan for diamonds, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. But, yeah, now gold is almost eternal, and so there's no need for it. It's not being used for most of its former industrial purposes. Hell, you go to the dentist and they put in a crown, they don't use gold anymore. They use ceramic materials. So the only function of gold is, well, I say twofold. People who are convinced that the sky is falling and... I wouldn't dismiss those claims. It's certainly drooping, even if it isn't falling. I think that somehow or other they can save themselves by moving all their money into gold. And the other purpose is basically human vanity. And that's absorbing probably 75 to 80% of all the new gold, simply going into human vanity.
Wow.
You've been listening to a recorded interview Sonali Kolhatkar did with R.T. Naylor about his latest book, Crass Struggle, Greed, Glitz, and Gluttony in a One-and-a-Half World Book. We'll play the second half of this interview tomorrow. R.T. Naylor is a professor of economics and environment at McGill University. His earlier books include Satanic Purses, Wages of Crime, Patriots and Profiteers, and Hot Money and the Politics of Debt.